Waikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Waikatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we are wrestling with a massive historical puzzle, really. It kind of flips the usual story of empire on its head.
It really does. The question is, how did a relatively small private company from London manage to, conquer and then rule India, a sophisticated civilization over 250 million people back then?
It seems completely improbable, doesn't it? But it's exactly what happened. We're diving into William Dalrymple's fantastic book, The Anarchy, The East India Company's Corporate Conquest.
And it's a book that forces you, really forces you, to rethink how British rule in India actually began.
Yeah, the core argument is pretty revolutionary. Dalrymple says this wasn't your typical state-led imperialism, certainly not initially.
No, he argues it was the world's first massive corporate power grab, maybe the most devastating one ever.
A private company, the East India Company, or EIC, acting like its own militarized state, completely unchecked. And this isn't just, dusty old history. It feels incredibly relevant today. A huge cautionary tale about what happens when corporate power isn't properly overseen.
Absolutely. And just to give you a sense of the sheer scale of what happened, think about the economic impact. India went from producing something like, 27% of global GDP?
Right. Around then, and by 1900, it was down to just 3%. Dalrymple estimates the wealth extracted in today's money is around $45
trillion. $45 trillion, wow. That number alone just stops you in your tracks.
It does. It really highlights this wasn't just political change. It was a fundamental shift in global wealth, a massive drain.
It really underlines the cost when, profit becomes the only goal, overriding everything else.
And the historian guiding us through this complex story is William Dalrymple himself. He's incredibly well regarded, known for books like The Last Mogul.
What makes him, I think, particularly suited for this is his deep connection to India. He's lived there for decades, hasn't he?
Yes, exactly. And crucially for us, as learners trying to understand this, he's fluent in Persian and Urdu.
That's so important because it means he's not just looking at the British records, the company archives.
Right. He's able to access and really synthesize Indian sources, Persian accounts, things many Western historians might miss or not have access to. It gives a much more balanced view.
A view from the other side, so to speak.
Precisely. And he approaches it not as some kind of apologist for empire, but with a real commitment to uncovering, some uncomfortable truths about corporate power back then.
So if you strip back the layers, the book is really a history of a corporation disguised as an empire story.
Yeah, it tracks the EIC's journey, how it went from this fairly modest trading outfit.
Almost like petitioners, right? Begging for favors from Indian rulers.
Exactly. Paying tribute to them. Yeah. And then within just a few decades, it completely flipped. They were the ones demanding and collecting tribute.
That fundamental reversal kicks off what historians call the company Raj.
Right. That period when India wasn't ruled by the British crown directly, but by this private company, the EIC.
And who were they answerable to?
Their shareholders.
Yeah.
Back in London. That was the bottom line.
And that structure, that's where the real danger lay, wasn't it? When the primary goal isn't stability or people's welfare, but just maximizing profit for investors.
It creates the perfect conditions for exploitation on a massive scale. The book basically traces this arc from the early 18th century through huge turning points like the Battle of Plassey in 1757.
Which we'll definitely get into.
Right up to the early 1800s.
Yeah.
By which point, they effectively controlled most of the subcontinent.
Okay, so let's unpack how this corporate conquest actually happened, because Dalrymple's detail here is fascinating. Early 18th century India, it's still a global economic powerhouse, right?
Absolutely. Producing maybe a quarter of the world's manufactured goods. Okay. Hugely wealthy. And the EIC starts out small, trying to get trading rights from powerful Mughal emperors like Jahangir.
So what changed? What was the big turning point? It wasn't like the EIC suddenly had better technology or troops initially.
Not really, no. The key factor was internal chaos within India. The Mughal Empire started to weaken and fracture after the death of Emperor Aurangzeb.
And then that chaos got turbocharged by an invasion.
Yes, the invasion by the Persian ruler Nader Shah. His sack of Delhi in 1739 was devastating. It basically crippled the central Mughal authority.
Ah, so that power vacuum, that fragmentation, that's the anarchy in the book's title.
Exactly. And this is the perfect storm for the EIC. They'd already started militarizing. hiring lots of Indian soldiers, sepoys, and European mercenaries, they were ready to exploit the chaos.
Which brings us to Plassey, 1757, often painted as this great British military victory, but Dalrymple presents it very differently.
Very differently. He argues it wasn't really a battle won by fighting. It was more like a corporate coup orchestrated by Robert Clive.
How so?
Through massive bribery. Clive basically bought off key commanders in the army at the local ruler, Nawab Siraj Dowla, people like Mir Jafar.
And it wasn't just military figures.
No, crucially, he also involved powerful local bankers, the Jagat Seths. They thought they could control the EIC, install their own puppet ruler. They completely misjudged the company's ambition.
They backed the wrong horse, basically.
Spectacularly. But the really decisive moment came a bit later, after a genuine military win at Buxar in 1764. That led to the Treaty of Allahabad in 1765.
And that treaty granted the EIC something called the Diwani. What exactly was that?
The Diwani was the right to collect the land taxes and customs duties in Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa, a huge, rich area with about 20 million people.
Wow. So overnight, they become a sort of government, a tax-collecting authority.
Precisely. And think about the implications. Suddenly, they didn't need to ship vast amounts of silver from Britain to buy Indian goods anymore.
Ah, they could use Indian tax money.
To buy Indian goods, export them, and make a profit. And crucially, use that same tax revenue to fund their growing private army.
Self-funded conquest. It's ingenious in a ruthless sort of way.
It is. And this system immediately led to what Dalrymple calls asset stripping. EIC officials, driven by personal greed and pressure from shareholders, just started extracting as much wealth as possible.
And the human cost of that? It was horrific, wasn't it? This connects directly to the Bengal famine.
Directly. Between 1769 and 1773, the company's relentless tax demands, combined with their mismanagement and neglect during a drought, it turned a bad situation into an absolute catastrophe.
How many people died?
Estimates are around 10 million people, maybe a third of Bengal's population at the time.
10 million. It's almost impossible to grasp. And the company?
The company kept collecting taxes, even at the height of the famine. Profits remained the priority.
That's chilling. Even when people back in Britain started hearing about this and they appointed Warren Hastings as governor general to try and sort things out.
Right. Hastings was a more complicated figure. He did try to bring some order, but the system itself, this corporate machine driven by profit, was just too powerful. He ended up being impeached back in London.
It shows how hard it was to impose any real accountability, didn't it?
Exactly. The drive for profit was just too embedded in the EIC's structure.
And as the company expanded its control, its real weapon became clear. Not just trade goods, but soldiers.
Its private army. By the early 1800s, it had grown to around 200,000 men.
200,000? That's huge.
It was twice the size of the official British army at the time. And again, funded entirely by Indian taxes.
An army built to protect corporate interests, paid for by the people being conquered.
Yeah. And they faced serious resistance, of course, most notably from Tipu Sultan, the ruler of Mysore.
The Tiger of Mysore.
Indeed. He was a formidable opponent, trying to modernize his own state and military. He saw the EIC for what it was, an existential threat.
But ultimately, even he couldn't withstand the company's machine.
No. The EIC's resources, its ability to raise vast sums and deploy huge forces, were just too much. Tipu was defeated and killed in 1799.
And symbolic end, Dalrymple argues, comes a few years later.
In 1803, with the capture of Delhi, the Mughal emperor, Shah Alam II, who the EIC used to petition, he becomes their pensioner, living on a corporate stipend in his own palace.
From sovereign ruler to pensioner prisoner, as the book puts it, the takeover was complete.
It really was. So if we step back from the narrative, what are the big takeaways, the core messages Dalrymple wants us to grapple with?
Well, the first one seems crystal clear. The danger of corporate power without accountability.
Absolutely. When a private company has military power, the power to tax, judicial power.
Right.
But its only real master is its shareholders demanding profit.
It's a recipe for disaster.
For abuse.
And you have to ask, how does that resonate today when we see private companies taking on roles that used to belong to governments?
Like private military contractors, for instance.
Right.
Or huge multinationals influencing policy in weaker states.
Yeah. The second big theme feels related, the privatization of war.
Right. The EIC had this massive private army. It highlights the inherent dangers when the state function of violence is outsourced for profit.
There are definite echoes with modern PMCs, aren't there? Operating in complex conflict zones, sometimes with very little oversight.
For sure. And the third major theme is that inversion of global economic power.
how India went from being this manufacturing hub, exporting high-value goods and attracting silver,
to basically becoming a source of raw materials for British industry and a captive market for British goods.
And Dalrymple is clear, this wealth transfer wasn't just a side effect of empire. It funded the empire, and it helped fuel Britain's Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, it gives you a completely different lens for looking at historical globalization and maybe even some modern patterns of wealth transfer, too.
Dalrymple really distills these complex ideas into some powerful, memorable lines throughout the book.
He does. He starts right out by saying, "The EIC serves as history's most terrifying warning about the potential for the abuse of corporate power." Sets the stakes immediately.
And that key reframing. This was not a conquest of one country by another. It was the takeover of a vast and sophisticated subcontinent by a private company. That distinction is everything.
It really changes how you think about it, doesn't it? It wasn't Britain versus India initially. It was a corporation exploiting division.
Which leads to another key point he makes. The conquest relied on the complete fragmentation of Mughal India.
Right. The EIC were masters at playing different factions off against each other. They couldn't have done it without Indian collaborators, financiers, soldiers, local rulers who thought they could use the company for their own ends.
So how can we, you know, use this history? What are the real-life applications for understanding this today?
Well, one clear way is analyzing corporate influence right now. The EIC lobbied Parliament intensely back then.
Just like modern corporations lobby governments today.
Exactly. Using donations, influence, controlling information, we can use the EIC story as a kind of historical model to see how powerful private interests try to shape policy, especially in places where regulations might be weaker.
That's a really practical way to think about it. What else?
Evaluating development rhetoric. The EIC often framed its actions as bringing order or improving trade, right? A kind of early development narrative.
But it was really about extraction.
Precisely. So this history helps us critically examine modern development projects or trade deals. Are they genuinely benefiting local populations, or are they maybe repeating older patterns of serving external interests? Neocolonialism, essentially.
That's a really important critical lens to have.
And finally, it all comes back to institutional accountability. The EIC's story is a stark reminder of why we need strong checks and balances.
To prevent private entities, whatever their business, from prioritizing profit over people, over the environment, over basic stability, accountability needs to be built in, not an afterthought.
Absolutely fundamental.
Wow. Okay, this has been quite a journey through a pretty dark but incredibly important period of history. As we wrap up, what's the one thing from the anarchy that really stuck with you the most?
For me, honestly, it's the sheer scale and mechanics of that private army. The idea that a corporation built an army twice the size of its home country's state army.
Yeah.
And paid for it all with the taxes of the people it was subjugating.
Yeah.
It's just such a stark example of how financial power and military power can fuse in terrifying ways when there's no real oversight.
Right.
It really shows how vulnerable even established powers can be when faced with that kind of focused, ruthless corporate machine.
That's a powerful point. For me, I think it's the speed, how quickly this sophisticated, wealthy civilization was effectively destabilized and then captured.
Hmm.
It happened remarkably fast, historically speaking, and it underlines the danger when a society fragments, when its institutions get co-opted by outside forces who just have entirely different goals in this case, pure profit.
Hmm.
It's a sobering lesson about fragility and maybe about the need for strong, cohesive governance that actually serves its people.
A lesson that still feels very relevant.
Indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.